House Labor Committee, Hearing Room E, March 20th, 1981.
More of the dog and pony show.
House Labor Committee will come to order. Representative Riles is excused.
14,250.
Karen's is still out of town, isn't he?
And Representative Karen's is excused, yes.
Chairman, Carl Frederick has something.
Yes, Carl, you've got something, I think, for the members of the committee that is actually very helpful. And
differential weights.
Oh, weights differential? Yeah.
We will be adjourning at 9 o'clock, so
I'm going to pass it fast.
Yeah, my comments will be extremely brief.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. That's my representative.
That's right.
Who was that? Was our mayor?
Nice typing.
Hey,
nice typing.
Yes, I apologize for the typing. I did that myself.
No, I think it was nice.
Very briefly, we're going to be using some terms in discussion of House Bill 2600, which may be confusing. And then, of course, we've got the first three terms, which will be eliminated from use. Temporary total disability, permanent partial disability, permanent total disability. And the new terms, of course, we'll be using will be total wage loss benefits. What I try to do is very simply describe what those terms mean and where, if you want further information on them, you can have cross-reference them to the current law. And then the replacement terms, if you will, I've cross-referenced to the particular sections of House Bill 2600, and I hope that this will be of some assistance to you as we wander through these rather confusing sections of 2600. That's all I had to offer.
Okay, thanks,
thank
Carl, very much.
You're welcome. Appreciate it. It's going to be very helpful.
Lexicon.
Dick, do you want to start your presentation? And what we're going to have to do is just back up our hearing schedule because we're going to have to spend, a couple of meetings at least just in the testimony and description of what it was. We'll rework the agenda and get it out to you as soon as possible.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dick Goss. I have attempted... I'm not sure if anybody can see that. I've attempted to distinguish between the present law and 2600, how it would affect what's presently called temporary total disability benefits. This is the benefit that the worker receives while he's totally off work and recuperating. Perhaps if I can move the board.
I'm going to move, Dick, so what... It'll be okay for him. I thought I would move and then he wouldn't have
to. Sure, just why don't you come on down and we'll move out.
The present benefit is two-thirds of gross wages. The wage base is determined on what the worker was earning on the day of his injury. So it doesn't make any difference that he was... unemployed for the preceding year, that he is, it is calculated on whatever he was earning on that day. The maximum benefit is 100% of the average weekly wage as determined by the Employment Division. I believe that maximum benefit is presently about $265. And so if a worker is in the 30,000 or higher bracket, it's probably even lower than that, 25,000 or higher per year, he doesn't get any credit for that amount that he would receive over and above the average weekly wage. The minimum benefit is $50. Now, under 2600, the computation is much different. First, the wage base is spendable earnings, a net figure. spendable earnings is computed by deducting federal, state income tax, and FICA. Then instead of taking two-thirds of that, we take 80% of the spendable. $2,600 would also require the employer to continue any medical insurance benefits that he may have been paying at the time of the injury. It would increase the maximum benefit to 200% of the average weekly wage. So workers who are in the $30,000 to $40,000 bracket would realize most of the benefit of being in that high wage bracket. The wage base is also different in that it is averaged over the preceding year. So if a worker was not employed for the entire year, his wage base would be reduced by that amount. But on the other hand, if he has been working two jobs, he realizes a higher wage base because he would be able to include the wages from his moonlighting job in that wage base. Presently, the worker only realizes a wage base for the employer where he is injured and does not realize any benefit if he was employed at night as well. The minimum would be 80% of 40 times the federal hourly minimum wage, which probably would bring it presently to $90 or $100 per week. So it would increase the minimum substantially. A couple other comments. Let's see. Oh, going back to 80% of spendable earnings. I'd like to talk about spendable earnings for a few minutes. The basing the benefit on gross wages does not take into account what the worker actually is taking home. If he has a large family, he would be taking home much more of that gross wage than a single person. So when a man with a large family is injured, he is in effect being penalized for having that large family. I'm not sure if that should necessarily be the policy here. The policy behind using spendable earnings is the incentive. If a single person is injured, his two-thirds of gross wage may very well be at least as much, if not more, than his actual take-home pay when he was working. Whereas the man with a large family would be severely strapped at two-thirds of gross wage because he's probably taking home close to 90-95% of his gross wage. So this, by using spendable earnings, you align the benefit with the actual take-home wage. Now, the effect of this, of using 80% of spendable earnings, there will be a redistribution of those benefits. Of course, a redistribution from people with fewer exemptions to those with more exemptions. There's also redistribution within some of the brackets, the wage levels. Those workers who are at the extreme low end of earnings would receive an increase in benefits. Those people who are earning approximately $20,000 to $25,000 a year probably will realize a decrease in the benefit. I think Carl Frederick has a schedule. He worked out some figures and has a schedule of how it would affect people at various income levels.
Mr. Chair. Representative Springer.
Dick, I'm sorry to interrupt, but can you let us know how overtime, vacation pay, some of those things fit into this formula?
Good question. If it, see, overtime would be figured into it because it would be based, subsection C and D provides for the benefit to be computed on what worker is reporting to the federal government as far as tax purposes. So anything that actually is taxable would be in the wage base. So any monetary as opposed to vacation pay would be included in the base.
I appreciate all this information. I read that section and I tell you it's tough. Medical insurance, the employer would continue to pay.
That's correct.
A worker injured when he's 20, the guy would still be paying when the guy's 80. Everybody's died, corporation's been dissolved, plans have changed. Maybe they had a certain level plan when the worker's injured at 20, but at 40 it's includes everything. Would he pay forever?
There would be some instances where if the worker would be totally disabled under the present statutory language, the medical insurance would be paid forever. For the most part, the people falling in these categories will be only temporarily disabled. And so the medical insurance would be paid only while the worker was recuperating. And then he would come back to work and be reinstated.
It also includes retirement benefits, et cetera, too, that would be continued on.
The present language in 2600 doesn't include retirement benefits. Okay. Only medical insurance.
I thought we did. Only medical?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the trade-off was on the other end where the offsets came upon at age of retirement.
He maybe only had to pay 40 years. Okay. And then one other question, moonlighting. In my district, I would think that the main moonlighting activity would be a man with a small acreage. 20 acres. So when he's not working his regular job, he's, you might say, moonlighting. Could this cause a lot of mischief? A court could determine that that would be part of his wages?
Only if he was paying premiums to for workers' compensation. If he was working acreage, he would be self-employed, and he would have to take out workers' compensation on himself. So as far as the redistribution of the benefits as a result of the spendable earnings concept, some of the lowest paid workers would realize an increase in the benefit. Workers at the higher end of the scale would also realize an increase in benefit because the average weekly wage would be increased to 200%. I'm not sure if there's anything particularly magic about the 80th percent. It's one that's being used presently in Iowa. I can see that if there was a substantial number of workers who would be receiving a decrease in benefits as a result of using the 80th percent, there's no reason why 81% couldn't be used or 82%. That's a summary of what happens.
Could you explain the minimum of 80% of 40 times U.S. minimum wage as it relates to the minimum payment a person could get? They're not clear on that.
Well, presently, the statute simply says that the minimum benefit is $50.
Yeah. Okay.
So you just take 40 times the average, the minimum wage, 40 times the minimum wage, which is $40.
Okay.
And then take 80% of that figure.
Okay. Now I know what you're getting to.
As a summary, what happens for somebody who is temporarily disabled, I have...
So the minimum hourly wage, then, we're talking about.
Yeah, the minimum wage. What is it now?
$3.25 or something.
Now, under the present system, after the worker recovers and returns to work, if he has any permanent disability, he's awarded what's called a permanent partial disability award. There's two different kinds of awards, the scheduled and unscheduled. The scheduled award is one usually applied strictly to the members, fingers, arms, legs, toes. And that's a fairly simple computation. The unscheduled award is all those other areas, though it usually, in a very high percentage of the cases, involves the back. And in those instances, not only the degree of physical impairment is taken into account, but also the worker's vocational capacities, his education, his age, the general labor market, many subjective factors like this. As it turns out, the average permanent partial disability award is approximately $2,300. Wage differential benefits would replace permanent partial disability under $2,600. What this does is actually compute what the worker has lost as a result of his injury. I've put the computation up on the board. The hypothetical situation is a $15,000 net, in other words, take-home pay before the injury, and he's not able to return to that job. He's only able to obtain a job that pays him $10,000 take home after his injury. The base, there's a 5% disregard, you might call it. Instead of everyone who suffers a couple of percent decrease in their take home pay, we're saying that not that 5% is close enough to the prior wage that should not be recognized, because we get into a lot of nickel and dime situations if we were to give benefits to anybody who suffered a 1% decrease in their wage. So we take 95% of the pre-injury take-home pay, and from that subtract his post-injury, and the benefit is 80% then of the difference between what he was earning prior to injury and what he was earning after the injury. You probably are aware that Florida has a similar scheme. They have used different percentages. In working through those percentages, I have found that there are some problems with incentives. There's some workers who come much closer to their pre-injury wage than others, and when you're talking about trying to get people back to work at a wage that's as close as possible to their prior wage, it's vital that the incentive is there to earn as much as possible. If somebody's benefit was, for instance, 100% of the shortfall, that would give that worker no incentive whatsoever to try to earn as much as he did prior to his wage. He could choose a hobby type job. He might decide to become a golf pro or a ski instructor, and have the entire difference made up by the benefit. So that's the reason why the 80% figure is used. Now, Evelyn Ferris's Workers' Compensation Federation did an exhaustive study of cases that they had and compared them under the present law with what would happen under 2600. And what happened is that there was essentially a trade-off. There was many fewer workers receiving permanent partial disability benefits under 2600, but those workers who did receive benefits received much greater benefits, and the cost came out approximately equal, as best could be determined. There was a lot of workers who could not be found, so it's not a foolproof study by any means, but it would appear that the cost to the system is approximately the same, but there would be a tremendous redistribution of benefits from large numbers of workers receiving very small benefits, the average of $2,300, to a small number of workers receiving much, much increased benefits, those workers who have really suffered as a result of the injury.
Dick, did we have copies of that study made available to the committee members? Okay. How about the Tillinghast? I think you've got them.
I have.
No, that's fine. That'll be fine. The Tillinghast. Did everybody get a copy of the Tillinghast report?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Let's get that to the members too. I think we've got them someplace, and
you're talking about their
the actuarial study,
the actuarial study,
and also the NCCI. You should have that.
I've got that NCCI.
And also the NCCI.
I think everybody has the NCCI. If you're talking about a conference,
yeah,
I've got that.
Yeah,
but there's also a computer run that they did on the formula. Dick, we're going to have to break at this point. And we'll get back on Monday. I'm sorry for the abbreviated meeting today. I know everybody wanted to hang in here for another few hours, so I apologize for that. And we'll get back on Monday then. I have here a letter from Sky Ferris on the request that we made that she would put together a question to be submitted by the committee to Legislative Council, and that is, the question is, under the provisions of Senate Bill 128, Section 17, the SAFE Corporation proposes to write reinsurance both in-state and nationally. Assuming that such a request is granted, and assuming further that SAFE became the reinsurer and a major catastrophe involving the insured occurred, in the event that SAFE did not have sufficient funds to cover its responsibility as the reinsurer, what is the responsibility of the State of Oregon to a quasi-public corporation such as the SAFE Corporation and to SAFE's insureds? So let's submit this to the Legislative Council for an opinion. Thank you. Sorry again. Goodbye.